Over the past few months, some highly profitable broadcast stations in Southeast Michigan have been letting go of some of their best talent. Why is that? Some might argue it's a ripple effect of congressional action spurred by the FCC during the Clinton years, the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Many longstanding rules, like a person or company only being allowed to own one station per market, were scrapped. Supporters argued the new rules would spark competition and thereby create growth and new jobs. Have we really seen that happen in the past two decades? Here with us now is Amanda Lotz, professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan. Good to have you back on the program, Amanda.
Glad to be here, Cynthia.
And we welcome Dick Kernan, a 50-some-year veteran of the Detroit radio scene. He's the vice president of industry relations at the Spex Howard School of Media Arts. Good to see my old friend.
And by the way, you were 10 years short.
Are we up to 60 now?
July.
60. Time flies when you're having fun. Yeah, hey, there we go.
I got no complaints.
And we'll talk about why it's no longer the Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts as it was. So that's kind of part of what we're going to talk about. Let's start with, Amanda, just what is the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and why did it come to be?
Well, it's the most recent wide-ranging form of regulation for the broadcast television and radio industries in the United States. And in many ways, it was an update. Really, the founding documents go back to about 1934. In many ways, a lot of our regulation is still built on that 1934 Act. And the 96 Act was an aim to update, certainly a much different technological environment, one that included cable, increasingly satellite television. And I think the really important part of looking at the 96 Act right now is remembering that it came to be on the cusp of broadband. There was definitely a sense that this new technology was coming, but there was also a lot of uncertainty. And I think the world that we have here 20 years later was certainly not imagined and not anticipated by the legislation.
Oh, boy.
Was it welcomed by the industry?
Some parts. For the big radio conglomerates and the big television ones as well, it allowed them to become much larger than they had been in the past. So there had been different regulations that were geared to try to keep all forms of broadcasting local and to encourage a diversity of voices. And many of those regulations came off. Specifically for radio, all of a sudden it became possible to own as many radio stations as you wanted nationwide. And we went very quickly from a big radio station group having maybe 20 to 30 stations to Clear Channel at 1,200. The makeup of the national radio business changed tremendously. On the television side, the limits weren't taken off completely, although the expectation was very much that in 98 or 2000, that the FCC would begin loosening those. And by that point, I think the response to what had happened in radio was so significant that there was a lot more public attention. And as a result, the FCC didn't lift those television caps in the same way.
Dick Kernan, as this was enacted in 96, what was the feeling in the trenches in local radio and TV stations?
I don't think anybody had any idea how this would turn out. The other thing that happened is the unfortunate recession that followed fairly closely after that.
Within the decade.
Well, the nice thing about this was the fact that you can buy them with very little tax problems. And so they said, hey, we'll take it. And so that's how Clear Channel got all these stations.
In fact, let's back up. For people listening, because we've got people listening all over Michigan who may not, when we say Clear Channel, those of us in the business certainly mm-hmm. know. So give us an idea of what Clear Channel has become because of having the restrictions lifted through this act.
It's become this gargantuan. They own somewhere, 800, 900 stations?
At a peak, they were at 1,200.
The problem with that is that when the economy started to sort of go away, they found themselves... Their debt today, it's called iHeart today. I have another word for it, but I won't use it on the radio.
All right.
Rhymes with heart. anyway, what it does is all of a sudden you're in debt up to here, and so you have to cut your expenses. And the easiest way to cut expenses is to let people go. And I thought we had finished that little thing, but it's still going on. You know, CBS was just an incredible radio group. Their stations were incredibly popular. Leslie Moonves has decided radio's dead, so he wanted to sell them. The problem is no one can afford to buy them. Hmm. And so what he's done is he's announced that the radio division will be a separate company, and they'll just take CBS out of the mix. They'll retain control, but it will be a separate company from the big CBS.
Mm-hmm.
This has been going on now for a long time. You know, I'm looking at an example.
Yes, as we were part of that, you're right. And when I started in my career, it was 1979, 1980. And I remember the stations that I worked for were family-owned, Crawford Broadcasting. Mm-hmm. When I started in television was Cox, the Cox family, Cox Broadcasting. And your competition was really your competition, and you would never dare mention a name or, mm-hmm. you know, you were focused on winning. And then by the 2000s, when I worked for Greater Media, our competition, there were three of us in the one building. We were all getting coffee together. They were our coworkers. And it still is weird for me to wrap my mind around hearing one station say, and our sister station on da-da-da-da. It's against everything that I learned when I started, but it shows how different things are. And then also when you have a huge group like Clear Channel or iHeart Radio, you can say, cut, 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 heads can roll. And by the way, we'll have one DJ tracking for mm-hmm. all kinds of stations. So I'm interested, Amanda, how has that changed the national landscape? We know that stations are licensed to serve the public. Is this serving the public?
I think we can debate whether or not the FCC has ever even had the resources to really evaluate that. Mm-hmm. And licenses, I think part of Telecom Act of 96 as well, was an extension in licensing periods. At this point, polling licenses is so rare. And I think you also have a population that isn't really geared to think about radio and television stations, aware of their commitments right. in order to hold them accountable. So I think we've got potentially policy failures on multiple levels. You have a population that doesn't know what to expect. Mm-hmm. And you have a regulatory agency that at this point is charged with so much and that has never really been able to pay attention to what stations were actually doing on the ground, except for, you know, a rare case of extreme abuse when a population did protest.
Or something happened like a Super Bowl Justin Timberlake, Janet Jackson moment that gets the FCC's attention and fines.
Exactly. To understand what has happened in from a business standpoint, the idea was that there were these advantages to be gained in economies of scale. Instead of, you know, just having the top 40 station in Detroit, if you also own the top 40 station in Ann Arbor and Grand mm-hmm. Rapids, you could effectively run them all pretty similarly. And that's really what has happened. In many cases, you have playlists that are nationally distributed instead of, I mean, those are where all those jobs have gone, where stations used to be fully staffed operating on their own. Now you have one person doing that job for a multitude of stations that may be in the same building, maybe in the same state, it may be nationwide.
And with the change in the landscape, Dick, Fortune magazine came out with its worst jobs in America list based on environment, income, outlook, and stress. Number one, newspaper reporter. Number three is broadcaster. And number four is disc jockey. Does that stem from this Telecommunications Act of 96?
Of course.
And how so?
Because you have to cut staff. And one of the best ways to cut staff is to have a certain small number of people who, in addition to being live on the air and saying almost nothing, are also doing exactly the same thing for two or three stations in Arizona or wherever. And so the need for those people has diminished fairly significantly. What's made up for it is all of the other jobs that now, and again, I'm going to use, you know, there is a company which you're familiar with, who do just great stuff. They still do radio. It's just so amazing to listen to what they do. They're live most of the time, and they do just a lot of things that radio traditionally did that rely on live human beings to do them. The other thing is that you don't have these situations in a lot of other places. One of the things that has become clear to me over the past umpteen years is what a great life you can have in small markets. Station up in Howell, Michigan, okay? Everyone there, 85% of their staff are grads, including the program director. And you can't go anyplace in Livingston County and not see these guys out there with their vans and stuff like that.
So it's existing in the small markets.
Well, and let me give you a great example. Yeah. 2 years ago, I was in Traverse City for a conference and spent time with two of our graduates. One is the program director of the rock station up there, mm-hmm. and she also does an air shift. And the other guy is the morning guy at the country station. They both celebrated, and this is 2 years ago, 30 years.
So if we dig down and get into these smaller markets, Amanda, are we still seeing the kind of broadcasting that existed where it was responsive to local needs, where local news is important and is covered?
I think it's really difficult to generalize. The general rap is that once you have this kind of conglomeration, that the local tastes and local preferences tend to get eliminated in the process. But I think we can also point to different station groups that do maintain, either with some or a multitude of their stations, some sort of local commitment. I think the example that I think of here in Ann Arbor, 107.1 is a Cumulus station. You hear that in their description, which means they too are owned by one of these giant companies. Their playlist, I think, is coming out of Atlanta. But they do maintain some, especially on the weekend, local shows and a commitment to the community. And I think the other piece that's important is the way that a lot of broadcasters have been part of the community, whether sponsoring sports teams or sponsoring fund drives and things like that. I don't think it's helpful to sort of paint with a broad brush, yes, sort of saying that conglomeration always does this. I think we have to understand the business strategies that are behind them. And in order to maximize those strategies, it does mean less of a commitment to the local.
I want to ask both of you, when you think of broadcast history, radio and TV history, how will the Telecommunications Act of 1996 be seen in the big picture of broadcast history? If we were having this conversation 50 or more years down the road and we're looking back and it's been a good 50, 70 years.
Well, I think, and to go to your other question too about how much of the change that we see in the market today is the Telecom Act, I think that's really difficult to pull apart because of digitization. And that's the other thing that has really entirely disrupted these industries and would have disrupted with this act or not. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that now the technology has become cheaper and can be in the hands of individuals, and individuals now have a platform to distribute, whether it's audio or video, that piece that's added new competition to the industry and sort of changed where advertisers are going, changed where listeners are, all that was going to happen regardless. So that said, the Telecom Act in many ways was both too late and too early. Mm. Some of the main things that it was trying to respond to, it eventually came together too late to really do what they were aiming to do, and at the other side, too early to really understand the digital marketplace. And so there's been talk in the last year or so of the need for another major act to take a look at the new competitive landscape. To some degree, we've seen the FCC being really involved with these massive conglomeration deals on the television side and regulating to a degree, and also moving into the regulation of internet ownership and the net neutrality policy. And so I think all of those pieces have bigger potential 50 years from now in terms of determining the bigger landscape than Telecom 96 ever will.
And from your perspective, Dick Kernan.
As Amanda pointed out, the thing that's changing, and it's changing at a breakneck speed, is all of the additional distribution systems for audio entertainment. As she points out, podcasting, this is the prevailing view in radio, is that podcasting is the next big deal. A number of reasons for that. But the point is, I compare radio today to network television back in the early 1980s. When you got home from work, you had two or three TV stations to watch the news on, right?
Right, at a set time.
And here comes this industry with all of these, the Weather Channel, come on, the Home and Garden Channel, that'll never work. And it works. And that's going to happen to radio. Radio is going to have to look for narrower and narrower audiences that have an audience that is responsive to ads that are aimed at them. And I was so wrong. I mean, I jeered and hooted at the Home and Garden Channel. Yeah, right. People, you're going to watch people hang drywall and plant bushes. That'll be exciting.
Food
and
Network.
The Weather Channel was worse. Yeah, the Food Channel.
Yeah.
And so you can't look at these things and say, yeah, but they'll never be as big. Well, really? I think we have an interesting, I guess, example of where I think a lot of radio will go. Can I ramble on here for a minute? There's a station in Detroit called WMUZ. Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah, I started there. That was
okay.
My first station.
That's the future of radio, and I don't mean the fact that it's a Christian station. I mean that I have never seen them turn up in a rating book. But I'm very familiar with the station. We have a lot of graduates who work there, and this is how they work it. They have a very, very narrow audience. But the great thing is that narrow audience never turns them off. They get up with them in the morning. They go to bed with them at night. The way that they handle their advertising is terrific. If a salesperson goes out and gets a little bit of interest, the salesperson says, I'd like to come back next week with one of our production directors. They go back the following week with, they have four production directors, and the production director asked the client two questions. Number one, what's the most important thing you want people to know about your product or your service or your store? And number two, what's your biggest problem? They go back to the station and custom make, I don't know, two or three commercials. They will not sign a contract for under 6 months. So you can't get on there for 2 weeks at a time. So they supply their advertisers with this built-in audience who hears their message all the time. They update the commercials regularly, and it works.
Interesting times, and it'll be interesting just to see how things play out. We may not be here. We may be watching from that great broadcast studio in the sky, Dick, down the road in 50 years.
I'm going to be way ahead of you on that score. Keep in mind, I've been in the radio business 60 years. What does that tell you?
Dick Herndon, a 60-year veteran of the Detroit radio scene, who's the vice president of industry relations at the Specs Howard School of Media Arts and professor of communication studies Amanda Lotz with the University of Michigan. Great talking to both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank
Always
you.
A pleasure.